Yeah. Very good. Okay, so let's continue where we left off yesterday here. So now we have come to page 41, I believe. The Arika Sutta. And now we are going to look a little bit at the ideas of impermanence, and of course that includes also death contemplation itself, so it is in many ways just a continuation of the themes that we looked at yesterday. So basically moving on from there, these suttas are a little bit more entertaining, if you like, not quite as dry. Some nice similes in here and some nice subjects which I just like to have a look at, simply because the Buddha looked at this thing from so many different angles, and it's nice to see some of those different angles, I think. Yeah. So let's start. So we're still working on the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort, how to think about things in the right way so as to abandon defilements of desire and ill will and this kind of thing. This is really what this comes down to. And then we are kind of heading towards right mindfulness. We're going to start to look at right mindfulness fairly soon. But first of all, look at these ones. So this is from the Anguttara Nikaya 7. Actually, I should say that yesterday somebody asked about the sutta on dieting, how to lose weight. And it's found in the Kosala Sanyutta, which is the third Sanyutta of the Sanyutta Nikaya, sutta number 13 in that sutta. It's very kind of simple sutta, but you might find it interesting anyway. So now to the Arika Sutta, Anguttara 774. And this is how it goes. Because in the past there was a teacher called Arika, the founder of a spiritual sect, one without lust for sensual pleasures. The teacher Arika had many hundreds of disciples to whom he taught a Dhamma such as this. Brahmins, short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So this Arika, founder of a spiritual sect, we're now looking back in time, a long time ago, so this is more like a story of the past. And sometimes you find these stories in the suttas, not that many. Most of the time the suttas are very kind of straightforward about the present moment, but sometimes you find these stories of the past. And he was a founder of a spiritual sect. He was without desire for sensual pleasures. And what that means is a shorthand for saying somebody who has attained samadhi, somebody who has attained the jhanas. That's really what that means. Because only this is the only way you can maintain the overcoming of all sensual pleasures in this way in the long term, is if you have attained samadhi. It does not refer to attaining the Aryan stages, because that only happens when you have a Buddha around, right? You become either a Pacheka Buddha or an ordinary Buddha, and then you practice according to that. So this is at the time before Buddhism has arisen in the world, and at that time the closest you get to awakening is samadhi experiences. So this is what this refers to. But apart from that, you can see it has a lot of elements in common with the Buddha's teaching, right? Life is limited and fleeting. Life is so short, bang, you're finished. It's all over. And that period that you have, well, there is a lot of suffering. There is some happiness there, but there's a lot of suffering also in human life. Not the least because we are going to die. This is one of the main elements of that suffering of existence. So lots of things in common, and that's why, of course, he practices samadhi to kind of overcome the shortcomings of ordinary life and then move on to a good existence in the future. So that is why one should practice the spiritual life. So then he has these nice similes, and these nice similes, they're all about how short human life is and how kind of insignificant it is. So let's have a look at these similes. Just as a drop of dew on the tip of a blade of grass will quickly vanish at sunrise and will not last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a drop of dew. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So this is very, very strong, right? Like the drop of dew on a tip of a blade of grass, like when you see in the morning, there's a dew on the blade of grass. Do you have that here in Malaysia? I'm not sure if you have that here in Malaysia. Maybe it's too, I'm not sure if it, you get that as well? Yeah, get that everywhere probably. Yeah. Okay. So the condensation, and then the sun comes out, and bang, it is gone. Before you can blink an eye, it's finished. And the human life is a bit like that. So, of course, and again, the idea here is that, remember, the idea of the death contemplation is to clarify the mind, to take away the intoxication of life. Yay, I can do whatever I want, right? That kind of intoxication. You forget what is important in life, and you kind of turn things upside down. And that's why the result of this is always that you start leading the spiritual life. You start leading, living life in a good way. Here, of course, it refers to renunciation. But generally speaking, just living the life in a different way is what it comes down to. Just as when thick drops of rain are pouring down, a water bubble will quickly vanish and will not last long. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a water bubble. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. It's interesting here also that I didn't comment on that. He talks about Brahmins. He calls his disciples Brahmins. And it's just an honorific term to talk to someone who is considered like higher in a spiritual sense, right? Because they are practicing in this way, overcoming sensual pleasures. So they kind of get the honorific term, Brahmin. Not Brahmins in the kind of caste sense, but Brahmins in the spiritual sense. So just like the water bubble, bang, the water bubble is gone, so life is finished as well. Just as a line drawn on water with a stick will quickly vanish and will not last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a line drawn on water with a stick. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. Yeah. Very strong similes, all of these ones. Of course, one of the interesting things here as well is that in each refrain he says that none who are born can escape death. Right? And that kind of gives you the answer also, in a sense, to the way how to escape death and how to escape suffering. And the answer, of course, is not to be born in the first place. If you are born, you've had it. That's it. You're finished already. But if you avoid getting born in the first place, that is really the solution to the answer here, to the question here. So, and of course, that reminds you of the idea of dependent origination, right? The last factors there are birth is the cause for death and for suffering. And this is really what this is showing as well. Birth is the problem in the first place. Once you're born, you are stuffed. You had it. So this is what this is about. And then let's go on to the next simile. Just as a river flowing down from a mountain, going a long distance with a swift current, carrying along much flotsam, will not stand still for a moment, an instant, a second, but will rush on, swirl and flow forward. So true, Brahmins, human life is like a mountain stream. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. And I like this. The previous similes are really strong on the briefness of life. They are kind of, that is the main thing. But this simile here has this idea of life being this swirling on, like rushing around, like a mountain stream, which is really fast. And we are a bit like that, rushing around in samsara, running from A to B, always on the move, always going somewhere. And where is that somewhere that we are going? It is going to our grave. That is what this is saying here, right? And there is no need to rush to your grave. It comes soon enough. And this is kind of the point here. But we are rushing, 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 thinking that we're getting somewhere. And only place we're getting is kind of into a little pile of ash at the end of the cremation ceremony at the crematorium. life is a bit like this, very hectic, very frantic, and very few people take the time to just sit down and be still and actually feel what life feels like. Instead of feeling life, they're kind of moving forward, trying to reach some goal that is always out of hand, always somewhere in the future. This is what craving is. You never actually get there. And because you never get there, then when you die, you get reborn, you continue running after that same goal that is always out of reach, always kind of slightly beyond the horizon, running around, and you've been doing this for lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, never understanding that the craving, the desire, the things that make you run in the first place, that is actually the problem. We're rushing on, not going anywhere, except for just going round and round and round, doing the same thing, making the same mistakes, having the same craving, the same agitation, the same suffering in life after life. Whoa, it is also kind of meaningless after a while. It doesn't seem meaningless. In this life, it seems so meaningful. We're doing something useful, getting an education, having a job, raising our children, kind of going towards something meaningful. It feels meaningful very often. Especially when you're young, you know, you think, oh, this is what everybody else does, it must be right. But then after a while, if you start to see the big picture of these things, you realize actually there isn't very much meaning there at all. It's just the kind of running around, with no end in sight. That is really the Buddhist teaching. And it's interesting here, and it's kind of feeling that you are on the right path when you found this teaching, the feeling that you can find a way out of these problems. So that is the simile of the mountain stream. I also like the idea carrying along much flotsam. The flotsam is like the casualties right on the way while you run around in samsara. There's always some collateral damage. Right, like they have in war, they have collateral damage. And there's a collateral damage when you run around as well. Because while we run around, while we crave, while we get upset about things, other people also have to bear some of the suffering that comes from your actions. There is some collateral damage there as well. And that makes it even worse, right? It's pointless, and there is collateral damage, and there is suffering added, just to kind of make things even worse. Okay, let's move on to the next one here. Just as a strong man might form a lump of spittle at the tip of his tongue and spit it out without difficulty, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a lump of spittle. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. I like that one. Human life is like a lump of spittle. It's really very graphic, kind of very sort of in your in your face, in a sense. Okay, just as a piece of meat thrown into an iron pan, heated all day, will quickly vanish and will not last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a piece of meat. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering and much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. This is kind of fitting. Human life is like a piece of meat. We are all a bit like walking pieces of meat, right? So so kind of fitting again to some extent. Okay, the last one. Just as when a cow to be slaughtered is being led to the slaughterhouse, whatever leg she lifts, she is close to slaughter, close to death. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a cow doomed to slaughter. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life. For none who are born can escape death. So every time that cow lifts a leg, every time she goes anywhere, the only direction she is going is to the slaughterhouse, because that is where the life of that cow has to end. That's the kind of the terrible truth about enormous suffering of animals in this world. But in a sense, we are the same, just like that. Every time we move, every time we do anything, we're heading towards the end, heading towards death, in pretty much the same way as a cow being led to slaughter. We're going the same way. That was one of the similes. I remember reading it the first time. I thought, wow, that is really powerful and really strong again, just to remind us of what's going on. Okay, and now comes the kind of the punchline, right? It really drives home the point of what he has been saying so far here. But that time, bhikkhus, the human lifespan was 60,000 years, and the girls were marriageable at the age of 500. At that time, people had but six types of suffering: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. Though people had such long lifespans and lived so long, and though their afflictions were so few, still the teacher Araka gave his disciples such a teaching: Brahmin, short is the life of human beings. Limited and fleeting, it has much suffering and much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. Right? It doesn't really matter sometimes how long it is. And I think this is one of those things that once you come to the end of your life and you look back, if it is 100 years, if it is 80 years, if it is 40 years, even if it is 60,000 years, and you look back, suddenly it's all gone. Suddenly it's disappeared, and suddenly it's like a dream of the past, right? It's just like now. What does the past of your life feel like? It feels a bit like a dream. It's kind of gone. It's not there anymore. The reality is now. You can never really get there again. In the same way, when you get to your deathbed, regardless of how long you lived, it all seems like something in the past, a kind of irrelevant. And suddenly, it's all finished. It's all over. So, it's kind of draws, kind of really... makes it very clear, this point about the human life being short. So that is kind of a punchline there. And then I've skipped a bit of the sutta, and then comes the very last part where the Buddha says, whatever bhikkhus should be done by a compassionate teacher out of compassion for his disciples, seeking their welfare, that I have done for you. These are the feet of trees. These are the empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not be heedless. Do not have cause to regret it later. This is our instruction to you. And this kind of, again, it drives home this idea that the Buddha is there. He is the compassionate teacher. The only reason why he teaches is because he has understood the truth and because he has compassion for his disciples, right? That is why he teaches. Actually, it is a burden for the Buddha to have to teach all the time. Much nicer for him just to meditate and experience jhanas and the bliss of freedom that you have as an arahant. Far easier for the Buddha. But still, he has compassion for us because he knows that he can help us to be released from suffering. And now it is up to us to follow that path, right? That is what he says, these are the feet of trees, these are the empty huts. That is where the real meditation, if you really want to meditate properly, you can meditate a little bit here at the BGF and you can get some nice results from that already. But if you really want to take a meditation seriously, sometimes you have to go on retreats and you have to withdraw a little bit from your ordinary life. Go away for a week, for 10 days or whatever, and it's something that I would recommend you all to do. Get away from KL. KL is such a large and noisy city, right? it's a nice place because you have Buddhism here and you have good Buddhist organization. That is great. But sometimes nice to get away from these large bustling cities and go to somewhere peaceful and quiet. You know, a good place to go, I reckon, is Jhana Grove Meditation Center. And I think it is because it is very peaceful, it is very quiet, it has a lot of also the resources there, it's very comfortable, so you kind of really relax when you go to a place like that. You get your own room and bathroom, right? That's pretty high standard for a meditation center. Most places you have to share rooms, that kind of thing, and it's nice to have that sense of seclusion where you can be by yourself in your own room. And then for a while you have like a halfway house to being a monastic. Yeah, you roughly follow the same rules as the monastics do. And also you get a kind of seclusion, not quite as secluded as monastics, but you're getting there, moving in that direction. And I would really recommend people to try that out every now and again, even if just for a few days, and then see what that feels like. And one of the great advantages of going on meditation retreat is that you find out whether you are practicing in the right way. Because when you go on retreat, you see, how good is my mindfulness this year compared to last year? How is my ability to stay with the breath this year compared to last year? And you can see if these qualities inside of you are actually improving or not. Yeah, this is actually a very important part, I think, of our life, because only then can we really make a judgment as to whether we are practicing right or not. And if you are improving a little bit in mindfulness, if your meditation is going a little bit better than last year, then you know that you're living your life well. You're doing living the virtue, doing all the sila parts in the right way. If not making an improvement, that is also very useful information, because it makes you ask the question, why? Why am I not making an improvement? And then you look at yourself, you look at your conduct, and you try to find a solution to what the problem is. And usually you will find it somewhere in your conduct, right? Somewhere, my mind isn't pure enough, I have too many thoughts of ill will or whatever, I don't have enough compassion and kindness towards the people around me. And if you look very carefully at yourself, you have to be brutally honest, right? If you try to hide, don't want to see the reality, you're not going to go anywhere. You have to be honest with yourself. And it is not an admission of defeat that you have a few defilements. Everybody has defilements. It just means like you're like everybody else. In fact, you're probably much better already, because at least you are intending in the right direction. But it's important to do that, to be able to make that progress. And then, right, and then one of these days, you go on these retreats, you're sitting at the foot of a tree, right, meditating in an empty hut. And that is when these results really start to hit home, because then you get some nice results in meditation practice. You start to see the world in an entirely different way, because now you're climbing out of the jungle, getting to the top of the pyramid, looking down, understanding life from above, from a bird's eye perspective for the very first time. And that's when you start to understand what life really is all about. And what a wonderful thing that is if that happens. So do not be heedless, right? This word heedless again, appamada. So be heedful. Heedless is pamada, of course. Do not be heedless. Do not have cause to regret it later. This is our instruction to you. And this is, of course, spoken to the monks, but it is, of course, also true for lay people to some extent as well, although perhaps not quite to the same extent, because you haven't got quite fully the same commitment to the Buddhist path. Okay, Araka Sutta. So, and now I'm going to read another sutta, which is also is kind of interesting. This is called the Seven Sons Sutta. Satta Surya Sutta, I think it's called in Pali, something like that. And this is more like a cosmological sutta. The Buddha talks about some really strange things, and you'll see what is going on here. And these strange things, they have a very close resemblance to modern ideas of cosmology. And this is what is so astonishing about this. This is one of the reasons I like to read this, and also because it has a very powerful message of impermanence at the same time. But it is quite remarkable and how the Buddha could think in this particular way. On One occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vesali in Ambapali's grove. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, conditioned phenomena are impermanent. Conditioned phenomena are unstable. Conditioned phenomena are unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted or repelled with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So this is the ordinary kind of Buddhist message that everything, all sankharas, conditioned phenomena is sankharas here. All sankharas are anicca, are impermanent. Unstable, I think is, I haven't checked the Pali, I think it's something like aduva probably. It is, okay, aduva, yeah, kind of standard word they use. What's the last one? Unreliable. Anasasika. Okay, anasasika. Asasika really means like it's not, you can't really breathe at ease. Or something like that's usually what it means. So it means like you can't really relax, right? Because these things are unreliable. You can't rely on them. I think that's what it refers to there, anasasika. But so this is one of these basic teachings of Buddhism. Very often when we think about these things, we think that we should contemplate sabbe sankhara anicca. All conditioned phenomena are impermanent. We think that this is something that we do in our meditation practice. We see things kind of arising and falling away. It's kind of the standard vipassana ideas when we go to vipassana retreats. But here is actually a teaching which is slightly different from that. And this is looking at these phenomena from the outside and actually reflecting on them instead. So it's a kind of slightly different approach to the idea of insight here. Into all phenomena being impermanent. So, but when you start to see this, you can see it still has a very powerful effect when you see what's going on. You get a sense of aversion. Disenchantment is the translation here. I don't really like that translation so much. This is the word nibbida, and I think contextually, other places in the suttas, it means that you become averse. You become kind of repelled by something. They talk about nibbida is what you get to a sore. If you have a sore on your arm and it's discharging pus and all kind of yucky stuff, you don't feel disenchanted. You feel slightly repelled. It's slightly disgusting, right? When a sore kind of expels all the pus and all the kind of yucky things that comes out sometimes of these things. If you are really ill and you have a boil or something like that, these yucky things come out. So I think repulsion is probably a better translation. But some people don't like that translation because they feel, oh, too much, I don't want to hear words like repulsion from all conditioned phenomena. Right? Especially people who are not really used to Buddhist ideas, they come to the suttas the first time and they read them and think, what? I get really put off from Buddhism when I see these things. But of course, the idea here is that when we do translate the Buddhist teachings, we have to translate it according to the Buddha and not according to people's feelings. If we translate everything according to feelings, we get a very kind of feel-good kind of Buddhism. But it doesn't go anywhere, right? Oh yeah, everything is so nice, no problems, no suffering, la la la. And then la la la, exactly. It becomes la 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 Buddhism. It doesn't become real Buddhism. And then nobody escapes from samsara as a consequence. So you have to be honest about what is there in the Pali. Otherwise, it is very problematic. So how then does the Buddha teach about impermanence in this particular sutta? And this is how it goes. So, because Sineru, the king of mountains, is 84,000 yojanas in length and 84,000 yojanas in width. And it is submerged 84,000 yojanas in the great ocean and rises up 84,000 yojanas above the great ocean. So what is that all about? And I don't really know, to be honest with you, what that is all about. But it is obviously about this enormous mountain. And 84,000 yojanas. A yojana is often regarded to be about maybe, 12-13 kilometers, right? So it means that you have to add another zero. So it's about a million, right, kilometers in length, a million kilometers in width, and a million kilometers down in the ocean, and a million kilometers above the ocean. Now, how big is the Earth? Well, the Earth is about 12,000 kilometers in diameter, and this mountain is a million kilometers, right? So it dwarfs the size of the Earth. So where exactly is this mountain? That is kind of the interesting question here. And the answer is that it's unknown, it's uncertain whether it's just mythology or what it is. But it could be, for example, that it is in one of the other realms, right? You go to Tavatingsa heaven or something like that, and maybe you find that kind of mountain there. That's just one idea. So it is still part of the universe, just not part of the visible universe. But the main point here is that this is not really important for the sutta. This is just like an added information at the beginning, which really is quite irrelevant. So we can kind of just leave that to one side, don't have to worry too much about what it means, and get on with the real stuff instead. There comes a time, because when rain does not fall for many years, for many hundreds of years, for many thousands of years, for many hundreds and thousands of years. When rain does not fall, seed life and vegetation, medicinal plants, grasses, and giant trees of the forest wither and dry up and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become dispassionate with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become disenchanted and become dispassionate towards them, and enough to be liberated from them. So here the idea is there comes a point in the future when the earth starts to warm up, and because the earth warms up, the rain stops, and the vegetation starts to die, right? This is kind of the beginning here. Perhaps also it refers to some drought, some really bad drought, when everything kind of dies. That's another possibility. But the general trend of the sutta here is about things warming up more and more and more. And that is what probably is going on here. And of course, if you do look at a modern kind of outlook on the future of the earth, then we all know that that future is going to come. There will become a time when everything dies, right? All the vegetation disappears. Everything dries up and just falls away. That time will come. It may be a long, long time away still, but that future is bound to come at one stage, at the very least. So it fits very well with modern ideas of how the future of the earth. Number two, there comes a time when after a long time, a second sun appears. With the appearance of the second sun, the small rivers and the lakes dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become averse or repelled with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So here we have this idea of a second sun appearing, and if you read the Pali, it is not entirely clear what that means. It does not necessarily mean that you have two suns at the same time. It can mean the second stage of a sun, right? There's like a new sun appearing in the place of the previous one. So it is a new stage of the sun. The sun has expanded, in a sense, if you like. It is warmer, right? And that is why when you get that extra power of the sun, all the water starts to evaporate and no longer exists. And of course, again, this is where things start to get really remarkable. The idea of the increased heat from the sun, right? This is exactly what we know from modern cosmology, is exactly where the world is heading in the future. The sun will enlarge, the sun will get hotter, and things will start to die out on the planet, and the waters will start to evaporate. Right? So here is the Buddha saying these things, that now, 2,500 years later, we're finally starting to understand scientifically. And the Buddha is here saying these things. It's quite incredible, really, when you think about it. So anyway, let us see where this is heading here. There comes a time when, after a long time, a third stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the third stage of the sun, the great rivers, the Ganges, the Yamuna, the Achiravati, the Sarabhu, and the Mahi, dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So impermanent are all conditioned phenomena, etc., etc. It is enough to be liberated from them. There comes a time when, after a long time, the fourth stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the fourth stage of the sun, the great lakes from which those rivers originate, the Anuttata, the Sihapapata, the Ratthakara, the Kannamunda, the Kunala, the Chadanta, the Mandakini, dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena. And it is enough to be liberated from them. There comes a time when, after a long time, a fifth stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the fifth stage of the sun, the waters in the great ocean sink by 100 yojanas, 200 yojanas, 300 yojanas, 700 yojanas. Or you could say they recede by that amount, they move backwards. 700 yojanas. The water left in the great ocean stands at the height of 7 palm trees. At the height of 6 palm trees, 5 palm trees, 4 palm trees, 3 palm trees, 2 palm trees, a mere palm tree here. The water left in the great ocean stands at the height of 7 fathoms. 6 fathoms, 5 fathoms, 4 fathoms, 3 fathoms, 2 fathoms, 1 single fathom, half a fathom, up to the waist, up to the knees, up to the ankles. Just as in the autumn, when thick drops of rain are pouring down, the water stands in the hoofprints of cattle here and there, so the water left in the great ocean will stand here and there in pools the size of the hoofprints of cattle. With the appearance of the fifth stage of the sun, the water left in the great ocean is not enough even to reach the joint of one's fingers. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted or repelled with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So gradually becoming drier and drier and drier until there is no water left at all anywhere. Even the great ocean has completely disappeared. Yes? Then there comes a time when, after a long time, the sixth sun appears, or the sixth stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the sixth stage of the sun, this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, smoke, fume, and smolder. Just as a potter's fire, when kindled, first smokes, fumes, and smolders, so with the appearance of the sixth stage of the sun, this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, smoke, fume, and smolder. So impermanent are all conditioned phenomena, it is enough to be liberated from them. So here the whole earth is starting to smoke, and Sineru is added there probably because it is one of these mythological things that people knew about in those days, so probably added in there, either that or maybe it had some meaning, maybe it was referring to the Himalaya mountains or something like that, I'm not sure. But anyway, it is there. But the main point here again is the great earth, the entire earth is starting to smoke and fume and smolder. So again, quite astonishing, because of course that is exactly what we know from modern science. As the sun expands, right, becomes larger and larger and larger, heating up the earth, all the water disappearing, and after a while the earth itself starts to get heated up to the point where it's starting to emitting smoke and fuming in this way. There comes a time when after a long time, a seventh sun stage of the sun appears. With the appearance of the seventh stage of the sun, this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, burst into flames, blaze up brightly, and become one mass of flame. As the great earth and Sineru are blazing and burning, the flame cast up by the wind rises even to the Brahma world. As Sineru is blazing and burning, as it is undergoing destruction and being overcome by a great mass of heat, mountain peaks of 100 yojanas disintegrate, mountain peaks of 200 yojanas disintegrate, 300 yojanas, 400 yojanas, 500 yojanas disintegrate. When this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, are blazing and burning, neither ashes nor soot are seen. Just as when ghee and oil are burning and blazing, neither ashes nor soot are seen, so it is when the great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, are blazing and burning. So here again, the idea that the whole earth burns up, right, and just is disintegrated, everything just burning away and disappearing as the sun is expanding, engulfing basically the planets. And of course that is exactly what we are know of now as a part of modern cosmology, that the sun will eventually engulf the earth as it expands. In fact, I think there is still a little bit of debate among cosmologists, how far the sun will go, whether it will fully engulf the earth or not, and to what extent the earth will be completely disintegrated. But roughly, it is very similar to modern cosmological ideas, what is going on here. Everything being destroyed. And the idea that it goes all the way to the Brahma world and that Sineru is also destroyed, it could simply mean that some of these things are felt in different realms of existence, because there is some parallels, of course, within these different realms. You have ghosts that can hang out in your house, right? And in the same way, there is some communication between these realms. So that might be what is going on there, although I'm not entirely sure why that is the case. So, and then of course, he drives home the point, so impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unreliable, so unstable, it is enough to become repelled with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to become liberated from them. So, here you have the Buddha taking a slightly different point of view, a different way of looking at the idea of impermanence, looking at the universe in a slightly bigger scope, and seeing how the entire earth, right, will one day disappear and be kind of completely destroyed by the expansion of the sun. It's very, very interesting, and of course, imagine, it's a very powerful idea. You know, when we know this in the present as well, it's a very powerful idea that the earth will be completely destroyed one day. It kind of leaves you with this feeling that everything is a little bit futile, right? You're building up our civilization, trying to control everything, trying to make everything perfect, and then one day everything is destroyed anyway. It may be a long way in the future, but still there is a slight sensation of futility about all of this. Where are we going? Ultimately, we're all going to destruction. Everything is going to disappear. And this, of course, is the power of this idea of impermanence. It makes it kind of very very powerful. And this is the real message of the sutta, to drive home the idea of impermanence, how futile everything is in an ultimate sense. And of course, extra powerful for us, because we know that this is true, of course. So that is the message of the sutta. But what I also find very interesting about this is the idea, how on earth did the Buddha know about these things? How could he actually know that this was the case? These are things that have kind of appeared in modern science very recently, that we are aware of these things over the last 100 years or so, that these things have become established by astronomers and such people. So how could the Buddha have known about these things? And this is not the only sutta that talks about kind of big events in the world. In other places, the Buddha talks about other things also have to do with kind of with galaxies and solar systems and these things. In places, it talks about how, you know, it says that there is the earth, there is the moon, there is the sun, and there are kind of different levels of beings, right? So it's talking about really about a solar system, our solar system, being the sun, being the moon, being the earth. And then he says that there are thousands upon thousands and thousands of such. So he calls it world systems. Seems to mean a solar system. There are such solar systems out there, right? And if you look at our understanding of astronomy, it's only very recently that we have discovered that there are planets orbiting other suns. It's a very, very recent phenomenon that we are aware of this. And now, of course, we have been trying to find out whether there might be life on these other planets out there. But the Buddha has already said in the sutta that there is life out there. There are, he says, 1,000 to the 3rd power such solar system, in other words, 1 billion solar systems out there, probably talking about our galaxy perhaps. And then he says that each of these solar systems, they have these realms, right? Human realms, animal realms, deva realms, and all of these things are out there. So, based on the suttas, and this is if you to check your conviction in the word of the Buddha, right? But it has to be the word of the Buddha. Based on these suttas, we should expect that eventually we will find life out there in the universe, because this is obviously what the Buddha has somehow seen, right? And predicting in a sense. There is also, of course, the idea that we find in the suttas sometimes, the idea of the world systems expanding and contracting, or developing and or evolving and then contracting afterwards. And that seems to be, it's very hard to know whether it is equivalent to what we are seeing now, but it seems to be the same as the Big Bang idea, right? This is also there in the suttas. And so it is astonishing, it is absolutely remarkable how the Buddha could have known these things. And the question arises, how could he have known about these things? How could he foresee that the sun is going to expand in the future? What kind of access to what kind of insight do you have to be able to do that? And I think the answer probably is that what he has seen the past, right? Remember, the Buddha recalls his past lives. And of course, when you recall your past life, you see all of these things happening in the past, because the universe works in a certain way. These are constant phenomena happening again and again in the universe, expanding, contracting, the sun, suns kind of expanding and swallowing up planets or whatever. It is always, has always been a bit like that. So based on past experience, the Buddha can then foresee what is also going to happen in this particular universe. Same phenomena happening over time, again and again and again. So that is how I say that the Buddha is able to see these things. But from a modern scientific point of view, most people who read the sutta, they would be completely at a loss to understand how the Buddha could have said these things. I gave a talk on this at our Buddha Center in Perth a while ago, maybe a year ago or something like that. And then after having given the talk and saying that these things are in the suttas, and saying there is really no logical way of explaining why it should be there. You know, for example, somebody has added it later on, right? Because these are ancient texts. This exists in Chinese translation, which separated from the Pali 2,300 years ago. This has been there for a long period of time. We know that. So it hasn't really been inserted in modern times. Nor is it really a matter of interpretation, because it's quite easy to understand what is going on here. It's not some kind of very strange doctrine. It's fairly easily explained. Right? So there isn't really much scope for interpreting this. It seems to be the case that the Buddha actually said these things. So I said that, right? And when you say these things in the Buddha Center, it goes onto YouTube and thousands of people listen to this. There are always a lot of people who say, what? You can't say that. You unthinking kind of religious zealot, right? Who believes this kind of stuff. And so some people are really upset by that because they think that you are just coming from some kind of crazy religious point of view. But actually, I don't think so at all, because what we are seeing here is we are seeing ancient text. It's there. There is no good explanation for explaining how it could be there. The only explanation really is that somebody must have had those insights. And to me, it actually is, if anything, it is evidence that the Buddha really did recollect his past lives. Otherwise, it's the only way that I can think of that he actually would know about these kind of issues. So that is the way I look upon this. So very, very powerful, very interesting. And of course, the majority of people will be more interested in the kind of the science here. Wow, the sun is going to expand, all of that. But the Buddha is not really so interested in that. For him, that's just philosophy. The philosophy of how the universe expands, how the universe contracts. And that is really quite irrelevant. For the Buddha, what is relevant here is to use that information to inform our spiritual practice, so we actually start practicing because we understand the impermanence and the problems that these big issues in the world actually, the effect they actually have on us. So it's strange. On the one hand, it is very fascinating and interesting that the Buddha should know about these things. On the other hand, the Buddha himself is not really all that interested, right? For him, it's just an example of impermanence and how the world is changing. For the Buddha, it's just philosophy, and philosophy itself is really irrelevant to the Buddhist teachings. You may remember the famous Buddha simile of the handful of leaves in the Singsapa grove. He picks up a handful of leaves, right, from the Singsapa grove. It's one of the forests in North India at that time. And then he says to the monks, the leaves I have in my hand, is that what is more, those leaves or all the leaves on the forest floor? Right? Okay, so it's pretty obvious what the answer is. We can all kind of get that. And then he says, exactly as the leaves in my hand are few and the leaves on the forest floor are many, in the same way the teaching that I have taught you, that is the Four Noble Truths, are few compared to what I actually have discovered through my own insight, which is like all the leaves on the forest floor. And a lot of that other stuff probably is more like philosophical matters, scientific matters, understanding of the universe, how everything goes, right? And most people, why didn't he teach that? That would be really interesting to hear about these things. But for the Buddha, the main point is not to teach about things that are interesting, right? In quotation marks, because for him, there is a problem to be resolved. The problem called suffering, and we want to get out of that instead of distracting ourselves. Once you start distracting yourselves with philosophy, it is bound. You're going to stay a few more eons in samsara as a consequence, right? This is what philosophy does to you. It keeps the mind running, 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 going around and around. So the Buddha minimizes that to an absolute minimum. But occasionally we get these remarkable insights from the suttas into the mind of the Buddha and into the sort of things that he actually knew. This is to me what is amazing. This is the kind of stuff that I can really relate to, because we know from modern science that this is true. But when I hear about a million bodhisattvas hanging out together on the vulture peak, that is when I kind of tune out a little bit, because it is not the word of the Buddha and it's got nothing to do with modern science. And then I kind of say, okay, whatever, just leave it to one side. Let's go back to the early Buddhist texts. That's where we find the really inspiring and interesting stuff. Okay, so the last sentence of this sutta. Actually, it's not the last sentence, but it is the last sentence that I have quoted here. Bhikkhus, who except those who have seen the truth would think or believe this great earth and Sineru, the king of mountains, will burn up, be destroyed, and will no longer exist? And that kind of drives home the point, right, that the Buddha realized that he's saying something completely unbelievable to ordinary people. How can anyone actually believe this? Because it goes so against common sense, especially at that time, 2,500 years ago. It's impossible to really understand this when you have no sense of cosmology, when you have no sense of the universe. So he kind of drives it home, right? So who can possibly believe this? Unless you have seen these things. So here he is appealing to those people who have faith to trust his word, that he knows what he is talking about. that again kind of drives home the point here that we're actually talking about a real situation when the Buddha speaks in this way here. So that is, I'm going to stop there for now. Anybody have any questions about this or comments or anything they'd like to say about these unbelievable events in the suttas? Everybody? Yes, at the back there. Is there a microphone, perhaps?
Bhante, when you talk about revulsion, is it... Yeah. How do you separate revulsion with something less subtle but nicer, something like disinterest? For example, you understand that these things bring suffering and you become disinterested with them without a sense of aversion to it.
Yeah.
So is it the same thing that you're talking about here?
It is the same. It is similar because it kind of goes together, disinterest and revulsion, but it's, remember, what you are seeing here, you're seeing something incredibly powerful. What you are seeing is suffering on a very large scale, right? And when you see suffering on a large scale, it's not just that you are disinterested in the suffering here. When you see suffering, you are repelled from it, right? It's literally unbearable. You can't deal with it anymore. You just, don't want to see all that. It's just like when you see on TV, you see some tremendous suffering in some country, thousands of people dying of famine or something like that. And sometimes it's just so horrible, you almost don't want to see it anymore, right? Because you can almost imagine yourself being there, because you are human as well. You can see the connection there somehow. And it's exactly the same thing. When you see the real suffering of samsara, it is actually very hard to bear. And it turns you away. It pushes you away from that. And that is why it is you are literally repelled by it, repulsed by it, and moving in a different direction. And then that leads to disinterest. And that leading to disinterest is precisely where craving fades away and disappears. If you're not interested in something, you have no craving for it, right? And that is the disinterest. And then when the craving eventually dies, you're liberated from it because you no longer have that interest there. It means you're no longer attached, no longer bound to samsara, and then it all kind of stops. So it is like that hot plate when you touch it, right, with a hot hand. It's not just that you are disinterested in the hot plate. You kind of, right? You are almost repelled by it in a sense. Yeah. That's what's going on there. Okay, everyone. So everyone else okay? Yeah, so let's have a break and then I'll come back again at 10:45.